Hello and welcome to Unfiltered, our newest program in our weekly Fixing Healthcare podcast series. I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books of Medicine podcast and CEO of Executive Podcast Solutions. With me is Dr. Robert Pearl. For 18 years, Robert led the Permanente Group, the nation's largest physician group. Joining us is Dr. Jonathan Fisher, a cardiologist and esteemed leader in helping healthcare professionals to prevent and address burnout. Robbie's upcoming book, ChatGPT MD, How AI-Empowered Patients and Doctors Can Take Back Control of American Medicine, is now available on Amazon and is already a number one bestseller on its new book list. All profits will be donated to Doctors Without Borders. Information on a broad range of medical topics can be found on his website, robertpearlmd.com, and on his monthly musings published the second Tuesday of each month. For 25 minutes, Robbie and Jonathan will engage in unscripted, hard-hitting conversation. As nationally recognized physicians and healthcare policy experts, they'll apply the lessons they extract to medical practice. Then I'll pose a question for the two of them as the patient based on what I've heard. Jonathan, why don't you kick it off?
Thank you. Robbie, congratulations. You are launching what has been a massive undertaking. And in reading your new book, I am really marveling at how it's written differently than any other book that I've ever read. And you explain that in the book. As we dive into this conversation, I want to hear about it. There's some things I'm really curious about that I would love to ask you. And I just want to tell you that my initial exposure to this whole idea of artificial intelligence was through robots. I watched TV shows like Lost in Space and then Star Wars and then Westworld and the Terminator. And I had this idea of doom and gloom originally, this dystopian idea. And the only other artificial intelligence that came to mind as I was thinking about our conversation today was when I was a little kid, we had a magic eight ball. And you would ask it a question and you would shake it up and it would say something that was some platitude that seemed kind of meaningless. And so very limited experience. But when ChatGPT came out this past year, I got really excited. I was one of the early adopters and I signed up and started playing with it and realized that it had benefits really to simplify my personal life and also in my professional life as a cardiologist. Haven't seen it yet in my professional world in terms of the healthcare system. And I'm really curious about how that's going to happen. And I can't think of a better person to help me understand where we're going than you are. And my first real question to you is, why did you write this book? You've written two books before about the culture of medicine, about involving the history of medicine. So why this book? Why now? And what's your hope for releasing this book into the world?
I wrote the book because I could see the impact that generative AI could have in healthcare. One of the abilities that I've garnered over time is this way to see into the future rather than focusing on only what exists in the present. And if you look at, particularly when the first version, GPT 3.5, came out, I was on podcasts and spoke about it as a toy. It didn't have the power and the ability to make diagnoses accurately, to allow patients to manage chronic disease. It wasn't yet reliable. And certainly the buzz and the chatter at the time was about all of its shortcomings and failings. But what I can tell by looking at the trajectory of the improvement, doubling in power every year and doing the math, that it would be 30 times more powerful. For a visual, think about an automobile that's now faster than an airplane. And rather than focusing on simply what exists, I thought it was important to get the message out about what would be. You know, Wayne Gretzky is famous for saying he never skated to where the puck was, where the puck would be. And I thought that was going to be vital to American medicine, and that the process had to be led, should be led by clinicians and patients together, not by some outside corporate enterprise. But as you know, I'd written two books previously, and although they were both very successful, It's a lot of work. You're an author, Jonathan. You're about to publish your book next week. And you know, it's a 2-year process. And I decided that, number one, I wanted to be able to do it quicker. And equally importantly, at the rate that that exponential progress was happening, that if I waited the 2 years that it normally would take, 6 months from completion of the book until a publication date happens, that it would be out of date by the time it first arrived. So it was the ability to see something and help other people recognize it. It's the ability to be able to provide information and motivate people to take advantage of it. And it was an attempt to figure out, could I speed up this process of publication similar to some of the ways we needed to increase the rapidity of medical knowledge and medical exchange?
I want to ask you a personal question before we dive into generative AI in general. What was it like having a computer as a co-author, having generative AI as a co-author? You know, normally we either write books alone, it's a solitary process, or we have one partner, or we've got a dozen people working. But what was that process like? I know that you had queries that you would put in, and there would be dozens of back and forths before you would have a response that was something that you felt good about.
First of all, it was a lot of work. But I want to point out to listeners that between when I started the project 6 months ago, and that was my deadline I set for myself, two releases by OpenAI, as well as other generative AI companies, would have changed that and made it so much easier. The first being plugins called GPTs that allow you to enter information. At the time, the maximum number of words that can be put in place at a time was 25,000, and I had 1.2 million word published that I had to put in. You can imagine how difficult that was to accomplish. And the second is memory, which is the ability for it to be retained. And many times it would drop all that information and I have to reload it. So it was frustrating in that particular way. But if I had to make an analogy, Jonathan, I think it's similar to when you and a resident or maybe even a medical student write a paper for publication in a journal. Resident or the medical student, they're highly motivated. You give them a task, they get back to you really quickly. Of course, with generative AI, it's about 3 seconds, but they get back to you quickly, but they don't quite understand all the subtlety. If you make it exactly specific, they can give you what you've asked for, but if not, you got to come back and say, no, I would do a little bit different statistical analysis, or no, I would shift that historical perspective to begin with the most recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it was very similar to that. On the other hand, it was also very similar to being just simply a writing partner. If you and I were to write a book together, I'm going to imagine we'd send 100 drafts back and forth. Every chapter would have 10 or 15 different ones. Probably there were multiple hundred drafts. And it feels really good to get something back from a partner that is either better than what you sent or at least adds to what you sent. And that was my experience. As you know from the last Fixing Healthcare podcast, when I read two chapters, one of the chapters I let GPT write by itself, essentially. I made a few changes. Some of the verb tenses were not as good with the technology as they need to be. I think that's only a matter of time till that improves. So there were 10% that I did, but 90% of it was written by ChatGPT. And listeners can decide how different it is from the previous chapter that I also read that was in my voice 90%. And my sense is that because of the time that we took to download all of the things that I had written, that ChatGPT learned my voice pretty well and was able to blend in. And I personally think that the chapters that ChatGPT wrote almost alone and the one that I wrote are very similar and equivalent.
It's really neat. When I was reading where in certain chapters, there's a back and forth between you and ChatGPT, and it refers to you as almost like a friend, and it knows you, and it actually adds counterpoints to your points. And it just was, it was a surreal moment, almost like Westworld. Like, is this Dr. Pearl or is this ChatGPT or some fusion of the two? Do you feel like you changed in any way you as a thinker and as a writer, as a result of using this technology in bringing this into the world?
I don't know quite if I would say I changed thinking, but certainly the final version was different than had I written it alone. ChatGPT is very good at providing a lot of information. I have to double check it and do source examination. One situation, it completely hallucinated a exploration of the North Pole that I could find absolutely no evidence that it actually occurred. And of course, that's not in the book. And most areas, however, it was very good. So I had added detail. I also was able to use it to change tone. Sometimes I wanted something to be a bit humorous or a bit more empathetic or a bit more scientific. Mm. And it's very good at being able to take the words that you write and at least offer you a starting place. And that's how I think we need to think about this tool today. It's both a resource and a starting place. It doesn't eliminate people. It just helps with some of the tasks that, for whatever reason, you're stuck on or finding it difficult to fully accomplish. In the end, I probably could have written the book by myself with a similar amount of time and work. It didn't. It may have shortened some of the time because it did a lot of the research for me, but a lot of people are using ChatGPT for that type of assistance. But in the end, it still required a huge amount of work, but it allowed me to accomplish the totality, particularly from the end of the manuscript to the publication, in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, it's remarkable how quickly you were able to turn around this this book and essentially write it with an extension, this AI extension. I'd love, really, this is as much for me as anybody else, Robbie. You know, when I think about this idea of generative AI, and in the book you talk about previous versions, narrow artificial intelligence, it can get overwhelming. And a lot of things can flood the imagination and can lead to fears for physicians and patients and for leaders. And I'm wondering, just for the average person, there's so many diverse applications of generative AI, let's just say in healthcare. How can the average person just think about these different applications, you know, putting them into categories? So how do you approach it and simplify it?
The first point I want to make, and you referenced it, is that I don't believe we should talk about AI. Talking about AI is like talking about a computer. The computer itself doesn't have a singular function. AI is not a singular entity. As you said, there's a algorithmic, a rule-based AI that involves humans putting in the rules. What you're going to get out is something that reflects how humans think. It's not that it's bad or good. It's just limited by the ability of us as people, as humans, to be able to provide those rules. Next, you have narrow AI. Here you have deep learning. You have neural networks. It requires huge data sets. The example in the book is mammograms. You have 5,000 mammograms that show cancer and 5,000 that either normal or show benign disease. And then the application can find 50 different ways and put probability factors. It can do a great example, but it's very narrow. It only does mammograms. It can't do brain studies. It can't do even chest x-rays. Generative AI is a completely different technology, although it still uses a similar neural network and deep learning process to accomplish it. But it doesn't start with specific examples. It downloads the entirety of knowledge. So far, that's been the internet, increasingly social media. I think over time, medical meetings, the cardiology meeting will have the talks located into generative AI the next day. It will change thinking. It will provide education more quickly. So generative AI, to me, is completely different, although it's still based technologically on the same architecture. And we should talk about the specific type of AI. So that's the structure. So how should people think about it? They should think about it the same way they think about an iPhone. An iPhone, we call a phone. It's not really a phone. I mean, it is a phone, but it's also a camera. And it's also a source of social media. It's also a tool to obtain retail things that you need. And you can go to YouTube and you can learn how to do repairs around your house. It is a source of massive amount of information. What's so different to me about generative AI is that it provides expertise. Even though you've never taken an art class, you can paint a picture that's, to the untrained eye, very similar to a Rembrandt or a Van Gogh. Hmm. If you have a, you want to compose music, you can create a song. We talked about this on a previous Unfiltered, the style of Drake. That's very similar to what might have been done, but you can't play an instrument, you can't sing. You can still create this, you can write computer code. And what generative AI is able to do, not today with the current versions, that is a good reference, but you need to consult a clinician. It will be able to do some of those things to allow you as a patient to reliably make diagnoses, to reliably be able to interpret all of the information on your chronic diseases, your diabetes, your heart disease, your hypertension, and allow you to know when that information is actionable or when you should consult a human. And we mentioned earlier the GPTs, the plugins. It can actually be loaded to reflect both the expectations of your clinician and simultaneously with the memory, all of your medical history, including your entire genomic sequence. So people should understand this as a tool, as a way to gain knowledge and expertise, as an assistant to them, and not just an assistant, but a skilled consultant, if you want to call it that. Will it ever be as good as the best clinicians? We don't know. It's too early in the process to tell. It keeps doubling in power and ability every year, and if the people programming it can overcome some of the shortcomings and challenges, it could be. But I think right now we should focus on its ability to help clinicians, and we know that's happening, and assist patients. You know, it's interesting to me, Jonathan, before the book came out, people knew that it was coming out. And I received dozens of emails from clinicians who said, I know you're writing a book about ChatGPT, but I got to tell you, because you probably don't know this, I entered data on my patients as though I was the patient. And the recommendations it provided was exactly what I would have told the patient. It was amazing. You should include that in your book. And of course, I'd already, you know, had that experience myself, but I thanked them nonetheless. But that is where it is going. So they should think about it as an incredibly powerful resource that will allow them, and that's why I use the word empower them, with expertise. Today, you go to Google and you click on a link, you get information. You don't know what to do with it. And it's not specific to you. ChatGPT, generative AI, all the other tools that are coming out from Google and from other large organizations, it will be truly a reliable assistant going forward. But let me ask you, Jonathan, if it's okay. You're an expert in communication. How do you assess this vital skill in healthcare looking forward and the impact that technology like generative AI will have on communications, on the doctor-patient relationship, on the relationship between colleagues? What do you think? How will it change? First of all, what do you think is the excellence or lack thereof today of communications in healthcare? And how do you see it changing once a generative AI tool is available?
Where we are right now, whether it's healthcare or outside of healthcare, communication is breaking down. This is breaking down because of lack of attention spans, we're isolating ourselves, we're misunderstanding each other as we're moving away from long form communication to a quick sentence or two, barely making eye contact with each other, oftentimes now shifting more towards text messages as opposed to even long form emails. And the trend, at least in communication, which is simply exchanging information, trying to exchange meaning with the intent to create something or to get our point across, it's just getting more abbreviated. And the risk is that it's going to become so granular and as to lose almost all of its meaning. And in healthcare, we can't afford that. We can't afford that. You know, when it comes to a patient handoff, if we don't communicate clearly with our partners, then the patient's plan is going to go in the wrong direction. If a leader is dealing with a crisis in healthcare, whether it's a financial crisis or an epidemic, and they are not skilled at communicating quickly, clearly, transparently, and at scale, then people's minds will fill in the blanks. So what I'm curious now, you know, is where does generative AI fit into this conversation? Because it definitely does. I've met lots of people, and all you have to do is look on social media, people or people's newsletters, and you can see that many of these are written or assisted by artificial intelligence. And your book is a great example of that. What's wonderful about your book is that the level of transparency that you have, that you are having a conversation with this new technology to help it make you more powerful in what you do well already. And that's what I'm interested in, is how can we augment our ability to communicate with each other? And I don't think it's a very high bar to climb, because of what I was saying is, I think right now we're struggling with communicating well. Physicians and nurses who have the worst patient scores often are the ones who have the least skill when it comes to just talking to other people and being understood, and getting that empathy across. So in terms of where it's going, we have early research, which you wrote about in your book, showing that if you give an average person, an observer, a choice between getting a message back from a doctor who's busy about a medical problem and getting a message back from generative AI or ChatGPT, people choose, by and large, the computer-generated answer because it's more thorough, it's longer, which people often use as a proxy for how good it is, and most importantly, people perceive the AI as being more empathic or empathetic than their human counterpart. And so for me, and this gets back, Robbie, to my big concern about where we're going with technology, is are we going to lose what has always been the foundation of healthcare, which is the healing touch between a human and another human being? Or can we see, like Wayne Gretzky, where the puck is going, and use AI to amplify our humanity and not detract from it? Those are my initial thoughts.
About 6 months ago, when the book was starting, you and I had a conversation on Filtered. And we talked at that time about a diagnosis for why communications have been problematic. And the conclusion was that clinicians don't have the time. And many of the things that you just mentioned about the brevity of the communication and the shorthand steps that are being taken, to me, reflect that. When I look at why they don't have the time, I point to two things, and they're both in the book, ChatGPT MD. The first one is the proliferation of chronic disease, which I think has created a massive burden that we've not recognized the impact. If you think about a population that you're taking care of, a certain number of physicians and a certain number of patients, and they all have acute disease, they can be very sick. They can have appendicitis, they can have pneumonia. But once they are treated, the appendix comes out or the pneumonia is addressed and healed, the patient's fine. You might not see them again for 5 years. If you have diabetes, we're going to see you 3 to 4 times a year. We're going to evaluate your hemoglobin A1C. You may come in with a long list of glucose readings that the clinician doesn't have the time to even look at. And so it's going to be an added burden. And I think that's contributed significantly to the challenges that clinicians have today, why they feel so burned out, why they feel so rushed, why they go home at the end of the day feeling less fulfilled, knowing that they could have done more if they had more time. It wasn't they didn't want to do it. Data shows it takes 27 hours for a primary care doctor to do all the things that are recommended by the best practices every day in order to provide optimal care to patients. It's just untenable. The second thing about it is I think there's been a shift in people and societies. It's certainly far more diverse. I think patients want to better understand their problems. I mean, they're used to booking their entire vacation in Europe now at home on Expedia with hotels and travel and sightseeing. You know, they manage their finances themselves without having stockbrokers. You go down the list of ways in which they're already doing so much in their life, and they would like to do this, and they want it to be personalized. And personalization takes even more time because no two patients with diabetes are exactly the same. And so we skipped all of those pieces, and I think it's eroded the excellence or the quality of the communication, and I think it's contributed to the dissatisfaction. 70% of patients think the current system is in need of massive repair, as well as the satisfaction and fulfillment of clinicians, for which you're an expert and hold wonderful educational conferences every year around. So I put that together. If that's the diagnosis, how do we create time? And to me, you create time by being able to transfer some of the work that can be done to the patient using technology. So that's the first thing that I see in terms of generative AI. And there's a second part in the book. And as you know, there are five parts to the book. The first three parts are about the technology itself and its application. The fourth is about the problems around privacy and security and bias. And the fifth, though, is about leadership. Because I believe that generative AI will not fulfill its potential unless we can shift from the transactional type of fee-for-service medicine to some type of prepayment, pay-for-value, capitation, a lot of words for the same outcome. And the reason I say that is the real ability to generate time is not the computer doing a task. It's the computer preserving people's health. If we could manage hypertension better, rather than 55, 60% of people being controlled to 90%, we would dramatically reduce the number of strokes. If we could better manage diabetes, less than half of Americans with type 2 diabetes are under good control. We could avoid a significant number of kidney failures. We could avoid heart disease in your area of expertise. Mm-hmm. So there's all these opportunities. And so I want to generate time by raising quality and recognizing the way to do that is by having more frequent communication, better monitoring and access, realizing that clinicians can't do that, but generative AI can accomplish that. I'll add one caveat, and I think it's really important. You know, whenever I talk to people, and these days I'm talking to a lot of people about the book, the concern that they have is the lack of perfection of the technology. And I turn to them and I say, what about what exists today? What about the 400,000 misdiagnoses that kill patients every year, plus 400,000 more that maim them? What about the 250,000 people who die from preventable medical errors? What about all the individuals who get heart attacks and strokes and kidney failure because we do a poor job of controlling chronic disease? What about those errors? And let's start to rethink this and ask the question, will clinicians and patients using generative AI do better than today or not? And if the answer is it's 50% better, then maybe we won't reduce heart attacks by 40%, but by 20%. And that would be a remarkable advance, creating more time to allow clinicians to see fewer patients a day, spend more time with each, delve deeper into the personal issues, and have the kinds of conversations I think they would like to have, but they don't have the time for currently.
Wow, Robbie, so thorough, and I can feel the optimism there. And when you said that there would potentially be a 50% improvement in care, you know, studies will have to show this. There's a question that comes to mind here. You've spent your career looking at the history of medicine and helping shift the future, but there's a new generation. There's a new generation of doctors and healthcare leaders coming in. And many of them, you know, the next generation are going to be native to the digital world, but not necessarily skilled in how to use this technology. We're not all computer engineers. Where do you see the role of educating people in terms of this technology? How early does it need to start? Are we going to have medical school classes on how to not only understand it, but actually program these things? Are we going to have to teach our future leaders to use generative AI? Or do you see us still having this massive disconnection between the technology world and the startups and our healthcare system, who is just going to have to catch the droppings off the table of the technology experts?
I predict that we will have classes in generative AI the same way we have classes in physical diagnosis, taking history. These skills are the ways that you provide superior care. If you're talking about the next generation, they are so technically sophisticated that no one will have to teach them how to use the technology. They'll be using plugins. They'll be understanding the amount of memory that's available. They'll be having shortcuts that their instructors won't even be able to think about. Of that, I'm pretty confident, because they will have grown up with it, and they will be completely skilled with it. They won't have to learn how to use it. They will have, it's like a foreign language. They will already know the language. So that won't be the problem. The thing they won't know, though, is how to use it to help others. And that's the skill of being a clinician. That's the doctor-patient relationship. And that's going to have to be taught the same way we teach it now in history and physical classes, learning how to extract the appropriate information, be able to do a physical exam, reach a diagnosis, and counsel a patient. But it will now be completely different. We're going to have to teach patients how to do prompts. We're going to have to teach patients how to enter the data, how to enter the data off of machines that today don't communicate, that are not interoperable. We'll have a lot of things to teach people. I've heard it estimated that it takes about 10 hours for an individual to become proficient at using generative AI. But that's the positive side to it, because it is so easy to use, so intuitive. And I think it's going to be a matter of a couple of years at most until it actually just talks to you. You won't actually be typing. The beauty of generative AI is that it has the ability to replicate all these other ways in which technology can be used behind the scenes. You don't have to program it to allow it to have a conversation back and forth. It can be easily built into the underlying technology itself. And as you and I have talked about in a previous Unfiltered episode, it will learn how people do technical procedures, how they advance catheters, using information off of operative robots or off new monitor screens. So those things will be done for us. And I believe it'll be one of the easiest technologies for people to master. The hard part will be helping people, patients who haven't been to medical school, understand how to reliably and safely use this technology, not just to do minor tasks, but to be able to obtain information. Give you one example. It's 11 o'clock at night. You have a couple of kids. One of them gets a fever of 102.5. You're a new parent, or got two young children, a recently new parent. What are you going to do? Do you drive to the ER, where you're likely to wait a couple of hours surrounded by people coughing with infectious diseases? Or do you wait till the morning, fearful that maybe it's meningitis or something else, that your child will wake up dead by the time the sun rises? You don't know what to do. This is the conundrum today. So stop for a second and say, what do we offer patients currently? Nothing. You call the doctor's office, you get a recorded message, go to the ER. Well, you could have known that before, but it's not a recorded message about your child or the specifics. It's just a protection for the clinician's office. Or you call an answering service and they'll tell you the doctor will call you back in the morning. We don't offer anything. You go to Google, you can't get the information you need. How much better would it be to have expertise? I'm not saying it's going to be perfect. I just compare it to what we have right now, and I think it'll be so much better. And we're going to have to train medical students how to use it. In parallel, by the way, Jonathan, I think we're also going to have to train them how to use it in their own practice, how they can use it to avoid the 400,000 diagnoses of people dying every year from misdiagnoses. How can they use it to avoid medical errors? And that is going to be hard, because it goes against the culture of medicine, the autonomy that people value so much, the belief that we are going to be superior to any kind of, and people using the phrase, cookbook medicine. No, this is going to be very sophisticated technology. And there's no doubt in my mind that good clinicians using generative AI will be better than the best clinicians that exist at the time that are not used in these particular applications. Mm.
I stand with that statement. I agree 100%.
So let me ask you one last thing. I just can't resist since we're now in the month of April, and I love the spring. It's my favorite of the four seasons of the year. And there's two holidays, at least, that we celebrate, Passover and Easter. And to me, both of these holidays have, I'll call them meta messages. For Passover, it's a story of freedom, liberation from oppression. And for Easter, it's a story of rebirth. And to me, they have applications into medicine. You know, health is freedom from pain and suffering. Healing is a form of rebirth. How do you, as an expert in burnout and in emotional issues, bring together this religious notion and this medical scientific world?
I love that you bring spirituality and these practices that so many of us find meaning in into a conversation about healthcare pretty effortlessly. And what strikes me about these holidays is the fact that what they have in common is that they're a way of marking time. And they go against the prevailing tendency in our culture, which is a sense of monotony, a sense of sameness. Again, coming back to this idea of just scrolling on the phone, that's the typical image of so many teenagers and so many of us these days. And so having a holiday that's been there for, in some cases, 2,000 or 3,000 years to mark the seasons, to mark time, it's more than a way of just sort of coming together with people who we're in a community with. The spiritual dimension of it, it has a healing element. And for me, it's about the meaning of healing. You know, we're in healthcare. We're about healing and we're about caring. And the biggest challenge my patients face are when they lose faith or lose hope that there's anything or anyone that's going to help them feel better. And for me, these holidays, whether it's liberation from bondage, from Passover, or resurrection and from in Easter, they're both messages of hope. And I think without that hope, it's very hard to heal. And to see ourselves as broken without a chance of survival it can be very disheartening. And so I think for me, the take-home message of these holidays, one is to apply it to myself and to recognize that whatever struggles I've faced in the past year, however bad they are, there is a glimmer of hope. There always is for improvement. There's a way to help other people more. And it also is something that I share with my patients. It's part of the therapeutic interaction that I hope generative AI brings with it, that installation of hope beyond just the merely technical, that however much suffering there's been, there's a long tradition of people having a belief in something greater than themselves. So those are my initial thoughts, Robbie.
I'll add to it that there's a level of gratitude that I experience because we take so many of these pieces for granted. Freedom to me being a great example. The fact the seasons do come around and that the sun will come up and warmth will return and flowers will come through the ground. At some point we can ignore it. And I make the analogy into healthcare. You know, when we're healthy, we just take it for granted. We assume we're gonna be always healthy. Mm-hmm. We can skip some of the prevention because we're healthy. We don't have to worry about catching a disease because we're healthy until we're not healthy. And so I think the part of the beauty of life, part of the augmented sensation of how wonderful it is to be alive, is to be able to recognize that these things are wonderful when you're healthy, when you're free, but never, ever take them for granted. Do the things that you need to do to preserve them, to prolong them, and be grateful despite some of life's challenges for all that we have today as humans in this world.
So as we talk about AI and all the great and positive things it can do for medicine currently and in the future, Obviously, AI doesn't come without some dangers and pitfalls. What do you both kind of see as some of the potential dangers AI could introduce into healthcare, as well as, you know, how would you address some of the concerns, you know, patients might have about AI being utilized in healthcare?
My thoughts, Jeremy, are one is that AI is going to be too good. It's going to be too good. It's going to potentially make some parts of our profession obsolete. And there's no doubt that that's already happening. On the other hand, I would say that there's a fear and a concern that it's not going to be good enough, that it's going to hallucinate, it's going to make mistakes. These mistakes are not going to be checked because humans are going to get lazy. The doctors and other people are going to stop checking the work that's being done by AI and maybe do what humans often do, which is take shortcuts. And there is potential for patient harm there. And so those are two concerns. And I guess another big concern, I've alluded to it before, is technology can either bring us closer together or it can push us further apart. And I've seen the use of AI so much now in communication that you may no longer have two people talking to each other. They may think they're talking to each other, but it may be one AI bot talking to another AI bot. Like this podcast, who knows, in 6 months, it could be a simulacrum of my voice and Robbie's voice talking to each other, sounding just like we do right now. And the same thing in the hospital system. And so there's the risk as we see AI doing what it does so well, which is creating robust, thoughtful answers with empathy, that the humans may feel less and less engaged, and it may lead paradoxically to more isolation. And then the last big fear that I have, the big concern that I have, is, you know, I get enamored with shiny things. I like the latest technology, and I think we may have companies and entrepreneurs looking to insinuate AI and technology in places where it doesn't need to be, rather than keeping focus on that human to human healing interaction.
My sense of technology is that every time new powerful technology comes along, there's always positives and negatives. Automobiles allow us to travel large distances, see family and friends, but 40,000 people die every year as a result of that. Narcotics relieve pain, but 100,000 people end up with overdoses each year. We could talk about the advances that happen in science and in technology, and recognize the smartphone allows massive amount of access to information otherwise would not have been there, to be able to obtain services and products in ways that are so much more simple. And yet at the same time, there's a lot of data about social media and the negative contributions it could be making. So to try to see a technology, any new technology, and not recognize the downsides, I think, is closing your eyes to what exists. I think the real question is going to be, what's likely to happen? And in some of the biggest areas, we don't know. I mean, one of the areas we talked about with generative AI is existential threat. And there is an existential threat that these machines become so smart that they figure out how to take over society to actually enslave human beings. Certainly there have been quite a number of movies made about this particular theme and books written about it. On the other hand, we have climate change that's threatening our world right now. And will generative AI be the tool as necessary to address it? I think these are the big long-term questions for which we can't say anything in the short run. In the short run, I think the biggest two problems, on one hand, is that people will over-rely on it. As Jonathan mentioned, they will stop doing some of the research and some of the thinking that's necessary and be able to use it as a shortcut. And that would be problematic. In medicine, if they start to rely on it right now with the versions that exist, I think that would be an error without consulting a clinician to better understand the information that's been given and to verify that that's the best approach. Again, that will change across time. And on the reverse side is that people will underutilize it. And that in many ways is why I wrote the book and my biggest fear that we have right now, that the problem will not be the technology, it'll be the humans failing to embrace it. And whether they do that, as Jonathan implied, because there's a fear about it replacing them, whether they don't do it because there's just a fear of the unknown, fear of loss of the things that will be taken away from the medical culture that's been built up for centuries. I suspect that all of them will contribute for some people. But in the end, my big fear is that an opportunity will have gotten wasted. I talk in the book ChatGPT MD about four eras, the healthcare 1.0, and we had major advances with CT, MRI, ultrasounds, heart-lung machines, technology that allowed human life to be saved and advances to be made. But we wasted the opportunity with the electronic health record, the application that essentially got in the way of doctors and patients, came between them, focused on the financial interactions, not on the medical outcomes. And still today, 25 years later, after their introduction, this inability of them to communicate with each other, to have interoperability. We missed the opportunity during the internet era and telemedicine era to be able to use this technology to make care more convenient for patients. We've missed opportunities and we've had other opportunities. And I'm really hopeful that healthcare 4.0, the era of generative AI, of ChatGPT, will be one in which we embrace the potential, that we recognize the flaws, the failures of society today, that we recognize the loss of human life, the unaffordability of care, the frustration of those who provide care and those who receive care. And we're willing to take the risk, to have the courage to make the change happen. And I believe in the end that if we don't do it, we will regret it forever. But that if we do, we have an opportunity to create a medical future that even 2 years ago would have seemed impossible.
Please follow Fixing Healthcare on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and leave a review. If you want more information on healthcare topics, you can go to Robbie's website, robertperlmd.com, and visit our website at fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at FixingHCPodcast. Thank you for listening to Fixing Healthcare's newest series, Unfiltered, with Dr. Robert Pearl, Jeremy Corr, and Dr. Jonathan Fisher. Have a great day.